This podcast is brought to you by DIA, the trusted global neutral forum for healthcare product development professionals. DIA, driving insights to action.
As clinicians, researchers, manufacturers, regulators, and patients strive to speed up drug development, approval, and access, drug repurposing has emerged as one way to simultaneously accelerate the pace of development and yet reduce its cost. But is drug repurposing as promising as it seems? I am Alberto Grignolo, editor of DIA Global Forum. Today, I am speaking with Dr. Christine Kolbes, Director of Drug Development Partnership Programs for the National Center for Advancing Translational Sciences, NCATS, at the U.S. National Institutes of Health. Dr. Kolbes' team is best known for leading the center's program on discovering new therapeutic uses for existing molecules, and she will share her expertise at the special Diamond Panel discussion titled Drug Repurposing, Where Will It Take Us? At the DAA 2017 annual meeting in Chicago. Thank you for joining us today, Dr. Kolbes, and welcome.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
First, how do you define drug repurposing, please?
I think this is an important thing to get us all on the same page. I think I continually refer to drug repurposing, whether I'm talking about a drug or a biologic that's already on the market and has approval by the FDA for a particular indication or indications, but then is being explored for a completely different use. And I think this is the most common way that the term specifically drug repurposing is used. There's a nuanced term of drug repositioning, which is often used whenever one is talking about doing something similar, but doing it with an investigational drug, an experimental drug, or biologic that doesn't have that marketing approval yet, and so it's sort of at an earlier stage in development. I tend to use the term repurposing in either case, but I think there is a tendency more and more to sort of make a distinction between these drugs that are in these two different stages, you know, those that are on the market versus those that are investigational. And it's probably a good idea because there are differences in terms of particularly access.
How would you describe how NIH NCATS, the center where you work, is supporting drug repurposing efforts? When did this program begin and what are your future plans?
So NCATS is a relatively young center. It was established in December of 2011. And our mission is to advance translation at all stages of biomedical research by developing, demonstrating, and disseminating methods, technologies, and processes that are broadly applicable regardless of the disease condition itself. Sometimes this is a difficult idea for people to wrap their heads around, but for example, if someone were interested in repurposing a drug for cancer, in all likelihood, they are a better fit for the National Cancer Institute than they are for NCATS. Unless the strategy that they're using or the method that they use to come up with the hypothesis is something that could be used for non-cancer indications as well. In other words, we're really interested in those processes that are going to be much more broadly applicable rather than in the specific repurposing project itself. As an example, our first drug repurposing funding opportunity was published in 2012. And while the research goal for that initiative is to repurpose drugs, the goal for NCATS really was to demonstrate the power of crowdsourcing and the value of template research agreements to get collaboration started between pharmaceutical companies and academic institutions. Mm-hmm. So the way that that initiative worked is that companies offered their investigational drugs that had been through at least a phase one clinical trial, so they'd already been in humans, and we had some sense then of what the safety and tolerability profile of the drugs looked like. And when they offered those drugs as something that they would be willing to make available for investigation by academic investigators, the company also had to take under consideration that they would be providing that clinical supply, including matched placebo, they would be providing that free of charge. And to this day, that's how that program works. So if you'd like, I can tell you a little bit more about how So the way that that works is once the company actually identifies which experimental drugs they have or biologics they have that they would like to offer, we post those drugs on our website and we offer funding for phase two trials. And if needed, investigators can request support for phase 1B and also for some preclinical studies if those are needed or desired. And when we're making the drugs available, we're telling them what the mechanism of action is of the drug, what the original indication was, what the route of administration is. And if we know anything about CNS penetrance, we also provide that. And with this information, we are hoping that the broader research community will actually come up with ideas that the company might not have actually thought of for how that drug might be useful. And so in most cases, these are drugs that were discontinued either because they failed to show efficacy in the original indication, or it was just something that was deprioritized for business reasons by the company. But in terms of safety and tolerability, you know, the drug has a reasonable profile and is something that could be pursued by another scientist if funds were made available. And so those academics then submit what we refer to as a pre-application to us. So at that point, they're not asking us for funding, but it's kind of like a letter of intent where they tell us, this is the idea that I have for how I would repurpose this drug or reposition the drug. And that idea then is evaluated by an NIH review panel. And we take those top applications and we put those individuals, just those top applicants, in touch with the relevant pharmaceutical company. And then together, once they actually have shared information both ways, you know, the investigator is trying to make a case for why their indication would be worth pursuing, and the company is also sharing additional data that they have, all under a non-disclosure agreement, together then they decide whether or not it's worth submitting an application to the NIH to request support for the phase two trial. So before any of this happens, NCATS has worked with the company that's offering the drug, and we have worked out a template research agreement and confidentiality agreements that they will then use with the academic institutions. And this is one of the main things that we were testing. Historically, you know, as you know, repurposing itself is not a new concept, and even collaborations between a company and an academic scientist, that's not a new concept. But what was different here is that there's no prior relationship needed between the company and the academic investigator. So here we were really able to take advantage of the science and the data that were available on these drugs and go out to the broader research community and say, these are things that are actually available that have already been tested in humans, and we know what their safety profile looks like. And do you have any ideas for how they might be used? So we were able to then put in contact investigators who have no connections to this particular pharmaceutical company. And in many cases, I think we were able to put the company in contact with an investigator that had an idea that they were actually unaware of that potential use for their drug. Our hope actually is that in doing this, we're demonstrating both the strategy of doing the crowdsourcing, but then by having these template agreements, we're hoping that that is also something that will be taken up by companies, by other funding organizations and funding agencies, as a strategy for doing something like this. Because as you know, a lot of times getting the agreement in place, you know, no research happens until there's an agreement that's actually in place, a collaborative research agreement. And that process alone can take, you know, 9 months to a year and sometimes even longer. And so that's something that NCATS is really trying to address through this strategy. And so our hope is that once we demonstrate how something like this might be done and how you might establish these relationships de novo, this would actually be something that would get taken up by other institutions, other companies, you know, anybody who has the resources to be able to invest in research could actually use something like this.
So in effect, your program and NCATS more generally are acting in a role as a broker or a clearinghouse, bringing people together, researchers and companies, and actually providing funding to academic researchers to take a particular repurposed drug forward, at least to some extent? Would that be fair to say?
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. Whenever you hear our director, Dr. Chris Austin, talk about what it is that we do at NCATS and talk about translation in particular, you know, you will hear him repeatedly use the term team science and that it takes a team. And it truly does. So in this case, our strongest applications are those applications that actually come from at least a pair where you have a preclinical scientist who really has a novel idea for how a drug might be used, of a mechanism of action that's particularly important for a disease, but that they have also partnered with a very strong clinical trialist, with a clinician who is going to be able to implement the clinical trial part of the study. So bridging that, you know, not only does this really facilitate that and broker that partnership between the company and the academic institutions, but I think in reality, it's even bringing together within an academic institution, bridging that gap that exists between the preclinical scientists and the clinical scientists.
How have academic researchers responded to this opportunity? And how have companies in the pharmaceutical industry responded to this?
The academic community has really, really embraced this. Now, as you can imagine, having the opportunity to potentially in your own lifetime, especially for preclinical researchers, to have the opportunity to have your research have an impact on health is almost a dream come true. I mean, most academic researchers are not simply going through an academic exercise. They really, really do want to have an impact on health and disease. And so we have had such positive responses, even in the instances where an investigator, where their application is not selected to move forward and to work with the pharmaceutical company, or in the case where they do get so far as to have contact with the company, but the company doesn't move forward with them. Even in those instances, you know, I often get feedback from them that they're disappointed that their project isn't going to be moving forward, but they're so excited that we are doing this and hope to see, you know, more opportunities like this. So certainly from the academic side, there's been real encouragement, you know, for us to continue to do what we're doing. And then for the pharmaceutical companies,
A follow-up, is that interest driven by the fact that, frankly, it's also a funding opportunity available to those researchers that were interested, because after all, NCATS might give them a grant, for example.
Right, right. Well, of course, that's always a draw. But, you know, the NIH puts out a huge number of funding opportunities, you know, every year. And there's always sort of what we refer to as the parent R01 solicitation, where people can submit their ideas to sort of pursue their ideas, you know, without having any special funding opportunity that's offered. I really think it's this opportunity to work with a pharmaceutical company and to be able to work with an investigational drug that I think makes it so exciting and so different. Now, I will say that because we offer that opportunity, we get a lot of phone calls from people who actually want to repurpose a marketed drug. And so early on in my answer to you, I had said that, you know, if you want to repurpose a drug for cancer, in all likelihood, you really need to submit an application to the National Cancer Institute. And this is because the idea of repurposing, like I said, that's not new. And the marketed drug, everybody knows about it. We're, you know, it's on the market. And so there's nothing that we really would be doing that would be changing the way the translation is occurring. So we generally wouldn't support that type of research, but we do have an exception. And that is that we have another funding opportunity announcement where if the idea, the hypothesis actually stems from use of a computational algorithm to come up with that hypothesis. In other words, you know, you had a certain input that you fed into your algorithm and it came back and said, we think that this, you know, this drug should be useful for this indication. In that case, if that algorithm is actually good at what it does, then it wasn't good just for your disease. It should be good for many other diseases. That is the one case where the algorithm might actually spit back and market a drug and say, we think this drug would be good. And in that case, we would be willing to support the research to investigate that. But if it's strictly based on literature searches and traditional experimentation, for us, that is not something that is really going to change the game in the space of repurposing and in the space of translation.
Do you own the algorithm in your program or NCATS?
This is the thing, is that we are actually looking for people to be using all kinds of algorithms. And there are a lot of them out there right now. And we want to give them a chance to shine and to really demonstrate the utility. And particularly, we are interested in not just sort of doing the preclinical animal studies to show efficacy, but we really want to see these things translate and go into the clinic. And over time, we anticipate that we will see algorithms that do a pretty good job of making these predictions, and that those are the things that then hopefully people would use more frequently.
What has been the response from industry?
The response from industry has been good, but it has taken different forms. We have had some companies that, when we approach them for subsequent solicitations, participating in subsequent solicitations and offering their assets, they've told us that they actually don't have drugs to offer this time because they thought it went really well and they decided to sort of pursue it, do a very similar crowdsourcing type thing within their company. So one of the things that I think the companies even learned was that, you know, the companies have their own divisions, and the divisions don't necessarily know which drugs the other divisions are working on. I think that they've learned that actually by even just crowdsourcing within the company and letting everybody internally know that, you know, we have this drug, here are all the characteristics, and, you know, is there anything else that we should be pursuing this for? So that has actually, I think, sort of changed things for them and was a little bit eye-opening for them. And then on the other hand, we have AstraZeneca, which actually now has their open innovation site. So if you Google AstraZeneca open innovation, you'll see that they have preclinical drugs that they offer, as well as, or actually preclinical assets that they offer, as well as a clinical bank, which oftentimes overlaps in what they offer through our program. And as I understand it, they're not offering funding, but if they actually like the idea, then, you know, you now have a letter from them saying, you know, if you would be willing to provide funding, we would be willing to provide, you know, the drug and work with this investigator to pursue the indication that they're interested in. So for us, this is absolutely fantastic. It's exactly the kind of thing that we envisioned. There are way too many diseases out there for us to be able to try to address all of them. Even if all of NIH, you know, were doing that, it's just too much. And so our hope really was that we would demonstrate some strategies that could be adopted by others, as AstraZeneca has done, and just sort of have this cascading effect and much broader reach and much greater impact.
Would you agree that industry would be able to do crowdsourcing just as well as you're doing it, and that eventually industry could latch onto this and just do it without you? Is it your vision that your program would eventually become obsolete as long as crowdsourcing and repurposing has really taken off?
I think we would all be okay with that. It is one of those scenarios where, you know, if we put ourselves out of business, then we've done our job, right?
You
so
job.
If we saw other companies do what AstraZeneca has done, I think, you know, that would be fantastic. And as I mentioned, they oftentimes are not offering the funding. So those investigators, I think, would still generally need to submit an application to the NIH and request funding for the research that they would be doing. But certainly, if the companies were flush with funds and could afford the funding, then they absolutely could be doing this without any involvement even from the NIH.
So is funding the biggest challenge for drug repurposing, or are there any different challenges beyond funding? What needs to change to address whatever challenges do exist?
One of the real barriers, and I think we'll end up talking about this in the session at the DIA meeting, is that we don't have good incentives for companies to invest in the repurposing of marketed drugs. You know, and as I said, we have a lot of people who contact us with ideas for repurposing marketed drugs. And even if that were the type of thing that we would support, we at NCATS in particular, can only support it so far. We legally can only take things through a phase 2 trial. So somebody else would have to take it past that point. And so
legally you cannot engage in a phase 3 trial or fund a phase 3 trial?
Right. NCATS, unless it's for rare disease, we are prohibited. Other institutes at the NIH, they could. They can support those later stage trials, but we are actually not able to do that. And so with marketed drugs, and particularly if they're already generic, as you No, you know, FDA can grant exclusivity for a new use, even if something were to get labeling, but enforcing that exclusivity is really very, very difficult. And particularly if it was an over-the-counter drug, then you really, there's no way to enforce that. So it's very hard to recoup your investment if you were to invest in repurposing a marketed drug, unless you're reformulating it. Yeah.
Right. There are ways to acquire new intellectual property protection through a number of different changes that can be applied, as you mentioned. So is that a way out of the impasse, in some cases at least?
In some cases it is. If, you know, let's say that you had good reason, good scientific reason for why the drug needed to be now in a slow release formulation, or, you know, it needs to be in a smaller dosage than it's currently available, and it actually needs to be manufactured at that lower dose. In those instances where you really have good scientific justification for why a new formulation is needed, in those instances, then there is definitely a path forward and in terms of recouping an investment. But if not, if there's really, you know, the FDA is not going to approve it just because it would allow you to make money if you reformulate, but if there's really scientific reason for why one would need to reformulate, that certainly is a path forward. And it's a strategy that is being used fairly often now.
These days, many people are talking about patient-centric drug development in various phrases representing more or less the same thing, the same notion. Can drug repurposing meet the needs of patient-centric drug development, however you would care to define it?
I'll say that for rare diseases, repurposing marketed drugs is certainly the fastest way to treatment if there is a drug that looks like it might work. It's very challenging when we're talking about a drug that's not on the market, and particularly if you have, say, an ultra-rare disease. And so in my mind, an ultra-rare disease is kind of the equivalent of saying a sort of patient-centric, sort of a customized drug regimen. In that case, where it's an investigational drug, it's not on the market, there is a question of who would actually do the manufacturing. The manufacturing is not an inexpensive cost. And so it does become a challenge, you know, in that sense. I guess I don't think of drug repurposing as being all that different than, you know, regular drug development in terms of being sort of, you know, more patient-centric than in standard drug development. I actually think we have another program at NCATS that's actually called the Biomedical Data Translator. And I actually think that that's more of a big data program where we're trying to address the issue of having huge amounts of clinical data as well as preclinical data, but these data are not interoperable. And if they were interoperable, we might be able to get sort of closer to being able to be a bit more patient-centric and being more strategic in the way we design trials and the patients that we would actually select, figuring out our inclusion and exclusion criteria. We might be able to do that more effectively and in so doing, be more effective and efficient when we are implementing drug development.
That brings us to the end of our conversation. Dr. Colvis, thank you very much for your time today. So interesting.
Thank you.
For DIA Global Forum, I am Alberto Grignolo.
To learn more about this topic, visit us online at diaglobal.org.